Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. Lauren Lax on the show. Dr. Lax is a professor of psychology and the chair of the psychology department at Fresno State. He has a number of research interests, including multimodal speech perception, perception of spoken language, psycholinguistics, perception of virtual reality, and video gaming behavior, having published a number of academic articles in these fields. We have a wide-ranging conversation that includes many of these topics, their practical impact, and a host of other topics, including free will and determinism, Neuralink, online language tools, the replication crisis, and much more. Please enjoy our conversation, and Baker will take us there. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S., Fresno's best! Fresno's best! So, Dr. Lax, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Lately, I've been really fixated on Cezanne. I really love the food there. I also like a place called Las Manzanitas, which is a little bit downtown. A great breakfast.
Oh, their breakfast. Let's talk about this for a second. Yeah, so I brought a friend who was visiting, and we went there right before Porch Fest last weekend and got the breakfast burrito with the tater tots in it. I mean, chilaquiles, just whatever. So what is your order there?
Chilaquiles. Yeah, it's delicious. The sauce, their sauce is beyond, right? It's just so good. I love it.
Okay. Make a sales pitch here, because I tried to introduce my wife to chilaquiles and she's like, it's just soggy chips. What would you say to someone that responded?
Yeah. It's like, I always think of it as breakfast nachos.
Okay.
Maybe that takes the sogginess out of it, you know, because you get to the bottom of the nacho pile, you got some soggy chips down there too with the refried beans, right? But, you know, this is just a breakfast version of the nachos.
Yeah. And I think when people try to make it themselves, they're not using freshly fried chips. And so they get soggier faster. Whereas if you use freshly fried chips, you're going to get, you know, I don't want to say soggy because that's kind of pejorative. You're going to get like a little bit of softness, but then a little crunch as well. And that's the ideal world. And not every place can do that, but I think that's aspirationally what they are meant to be.
Yeah. So it's kind of like when you pour yourself a bowl of Frosted Flakes, you know, at the top, crunchy. You got to eat it at just the right pace so that they're not fully soggy by the end of the bowl, right? You got to get a little bit of crunch right at the bottom.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad that we both share a love for that place. That place is amazing. And it's probably the most underrated food in Fresno, just because when I go in there, I see people in there, but there should be big lines based on what I eat there.
For sure. But let's keep it a secret instead of blasting it to the whole of Fresno.
Well, that game is over now. So we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff today, but I want to start by talking about your background a little bit and starting with your education. Let's say that you knew you were going to pursue your PhD in psychology, but were forced to study something else, not cognitive science, not psychology, but something else in your undergrad that would enhance your career as a psychologist. What would that be?
Oh, wow. That would enhance my career as a psychologist. Well, I mean, I got to cognitive science kind of in a circuitous this way. I was an English major first, and then I was pre-med, and then I was a neuroscience major. And, you know, that's a lot more biology kind of focus, you know, test tubes, centrifuges and things. And I really enjoyed the biological aspects of neuroscience, but I took a couple of psychology classes in language, and that's what kind of sent me over to the cognitive science side. So I suppose I would have continued studying neuroscience if I hadn't been a psych major.
Think the average psychologist has enough understanding of biology in order to do their job well? Or do you think that would enhance a typical psychologist's approach to their research?
You know, I'm not sure, but what I do know is that in the Fresno State Psychology Department, we've actually started changing the curriculum to incorporate more biological foundations. I mean, someone who's going to be a clinical psychologist doesn't necessarily have to know how the retina works in detail, but they should know a little bit about neurons and neurotransmitters, especially with all the new psychoactive drugs that are coming out there as therapy. You know, they should have at least a little bit of an understanding of what it's doing biologically.
Okay. What would you say, just based on your perspective now, would be the biggest difference between the training that you received in neuroscience at Brandeis and then the way neuroscience is taught today?
There's just a lot more known. I mean, I'm pretty old here. So I was an undergrad 25 years ago, and at that time, the amount of knowledge, it was really the beginning of sort of a burst of knowledge in neuroscience. So at that point in time, there wasn't a ton known. It was pretty rudimentary, just in terms of how neurons interacted with each other. One example I always give is that some cells in the brain, they were thought to have nothing to do with the firing of neurons, and it wasn't clear what they did. And now we know that they actually modify the firing of neurons in various patterns. So even though the pattern of activity across neurons is important, these other cells modify that, shape it in ways that are less directly about that pattern of activation. And I think that's a pretty good example of something that's come out in the last 25 years that enhances our knowledge of how things go.
Yeah, and I would say for people, people that were educated 15, 20, 25, 30 years ago in biology, there's so much that's changed in our understanding. I mean, there's a great book that came out last year by Philip Ball, who's the editor of Nature, called How Life Works: A User's Guide to the New Biology. And like just reading that book, I was like, oh my God, like my biology class today and biology class that I took in high school, 20 years ago, like that's just, there's such a contrast there. And I don't think people fully grasp how different things are based on our new knowledge that we've acquired.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a good thing, right? I mean, that's how science is supposed to work. Even my home field now of perception, since I started teaching it when I first got the job here 20 years ago, it has evolved drastically in ways that I would never have predicted, back then.
Okay. Now, in terms of your PhD program, do you think it's important to come in with a clear research interest or goal, or how much should you rely on faculty members to develop those?
That's a really great question. I get that a lot from students. I always say you got to narrow it down to like a broad topic. So if you think about the names of the chapters in an intro to psych book, right? Like that's where you want to live in terms of your interest. But beyond that, you could get a little bit more specific, but I think it helps to keep an open mind when you walk in. You want to end up with a faculty mentor who's working in an area that you're intrinsically motivated to pursue, but you don't really have the knowledge to propose a research question of any consequence, like when you're walking in the door. Maybe some people do, but most people don't. And as you go along, if you start with what the PI of your lab is researching, you'll eventually be coming up with your own ideas. And in fact, you're expected to come up with your own ideas and bring new areas into the lab. And that's where the creativity comes in, right? You're sort of diverging from your mentor's research interests by bringing in other things that you learned along the way that didn't quite come from their lab. So I would say coming in the door, you don't really need to have a very narrow focus, but walking out, you absolutely will have one.
Yeah, we kind of have to unteach students a little bit because they've been trained through K-12 that the goal is to find the right answer, and then when they get to
Yes.
university, they realize that it's actually learning to find the right question. And that's kind of a hard conceptual leap for a lot of students, and I get why, just because, that's the way our education is set up. And speaking of
I
education,
couldn't.
do you think pedagogy should be a more critical component of PhD programs? And do you think that's why, in a lot of ways, universities struggle with kind of adapting from their more conservative approaches to, lecture, test, essay, those kinds of things?
Yeah, I 100% do. In fact, the PhD program I went to at Indiana University, one of the reasons I even applied to it was because it had embedded in the curriculum, you had to teach a class, not be a TA, not be a research assistant, like literally teach an entire class. And there was a support class for that class. So, I had to teach experimental methods, and the semester prior to that, I had to take a class on how to teach experimental methods. So I learned a lot about different techniques, different ideas, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, how do you deal with students, all the stuff that goes into teaching. I thought it was really, really important. And at Fresno State, we are a what's called a R2 institution, which is sort of research and teaching kind of institution. So we prioritize hiring faculty who are good teachers. But even so, we have professional development in the university to teach us how to continue to be like at the top of our game for teaching. And I think it's absolutely critical. You find a lot of people who are extremely bright geniuses levels, you know, in terms of their own research, but they have no idea how to communicate those ideas. And that's half the battle.
Yeah, I often talk to my more conservative friends, and they bemoan the fact that universities are so progressive, and you know, there's not a lot of ideological diversity. And then I often push back and say, my biggest problem is that they're too conservative in terms of pedagogy. And that often makes a bigger difference than whatever kind of implicit political philosophy a professor is bringing to a classroom, is how they approach their classroom and teach. But that's a whole nother subject we could dive into.
You know, the act of teaching actually helps you understand the thing that you're trying to understand anyway, right? We know that the best way for a student to understand a topic is for them to repeat it back or, you know, teach it to someone else. So even I, 22 years into this game, like I still learn things as I'm teaching these classes with insights, or, you know, maybe it comes out a different way. This one time I speak in lecture and gives me some kind of new understanding of what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Now, in terms of mentors, do you tend to remember mentors more for their intellectual brilliance or your interpersonal relationships with them?
That's a great question. I haven't really thought about it, but I mean, I'll say that they were all brilliant, right? Mm-hmm. But if I think about why I resonated with them, I think it's probably on the interpersonal relationship level, right? One person in particular who I remember, his name is Jeff Bingham. Just the nicest person ever. And I would go into his office and we would just like have conversations about stuff. It didn't really feel like teaching or, you know, asking questions. It was more like a dialogue. So I got a lot out of him just learning about his field, but also I think that was helped and aided. And I probably was drawn to it because it was just easy to talk to him and it didn't feel like work. It just felt like hanging around with your friend and, you know, talking about something that you're both interested in. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I definitely think in almost every industry, conscientiousness is underrated as a skill and an attribute for people. You know, you can have the most brilliant person, but if they're impossible to work with, what does it matter? And so I think that's true in academia as well.
Oh, yeah.
I have a number of questions about speech perception, but I wanted to just kind of give you the opportunity to start, because it seems in some ways like it's a field that maybe people are aware of, but don't know the depth and complexity of it. Can you give maybe just a 1 to 2 minute sketch overview of the field so people understand kind of the basis of what we're talking about?
And just to clarify, I didn't hear you said speech perception.
Yeah. That field
yeah.
in particular.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I always use is like Siri, or, you know, the person who's under my desk right now, whose name I can't say, who starts with an A. But, you know, that when you talk to that person or that computer, it doesn't happen on your phone, the recognition of what you're saying. It goes to a bank of lots and lots and lots of computers that do amazing amounts of processing on it before it comes back and A, comprehends what you said, B, tries to get the intent of the words behind what you said, and then responds appropriately, and, you know, creates an acoustic pattern that responds to you. And that process is very computationally complex on a phone, but humans learn how to do it and do it almost effortlessly in about 2 years of life, right? So the question is, what is it about human brains that facilitates that process? How do they work? What do they have to do? There's questions about, you know, first of all, what is the brain even looking for? So at a very deep level, you might think, well, you know, certain sounds must mean certain letters, right? You know, whenever you hear this pattern of sounds, that means a B. And whenever you hear this pattern of sounds, that means an X or whatever it is. It turns out it's not even that straightforward. There's no one-to-one relationship between the sounds that come out of your mouth and the letters, or the phonemes, as we say in the business. There's no one-to-one relationship. It's all context dependent. If I say the word deep and I say the word dupe, you would think that the beginning and the end of both of those words would acoustically look exactly the same, but they don't. And it has to do with the vowel in the middle. So, how are brains accounting for that? The acoustics come out in time. You feel like you're understanding someone as they're speaking to you, but there's got to be at least a little bit of a delay because something that comes after the vowel is modifying how you interpret the first consonant in those two words, deep and dupe. So that's at a really basic fundamental level. Then there's all sorts of other things, like when I say the word cat and you say the word cat, or my child says the word cat, the acoustics are different there. How does your brain parse out the information about the vocal tract, the actual person who's speaking? And what is done with that information? You recognize something about who the person is, maybe what gender they are, maybe what part of the country they're from, if they're speaking English, maybe what part of the world they're from, if they're speaking English with a foreign language accent. So just at a really simple level, the actual sounds coming out of your mouth are not straightforwardly related to the words that you intend to mean. Then once you get there, you have to start talking about grammar. I could say a sequence of words like the famous phrase, colorless green ideas sleep furiously. That's a grammatical sentence in English, but it doesn't mean anything. So something about human brains must be able to recognize grammaticality absent any sort of meaning. And then finally, once that happens, you have to figure out what the person means. You could say, close the door. You could say, I'm really chilly, and then sort of like look meaningfully at a door. And they mean the same thing, but the words are completely different, right? And it has a lot to do with other gestures. How does your brain figure out what the intended meaning is? Because there's no one-to-one relationship between the words that are actually spoken and the meaning that is intended. So there's a lot of ambiguity and not a very straightforward process at each level. That's what a speech perception person looks into. They try to find out, all those steps, what's involved.
It was such a fascinating field for me to explore. Before we jump into some of the questions that I was curious about, just looking at the research and some of the meta-analyses that I read, I was curious, and we'll talk about Daniel Kahneman in a little bit, but someone asked Daniel Kahneman a while back, he passed away obviously recently, but a while back they asked him, because he's done so much research on cognitive biases and things like that. And they asked him if that made him a better decision maker. And he said, well, I'm just a human. So, doing research doesn't necessarily mean that you can implement it better or that it's going to, you can solve the challenge of being a human. That's just part of being a
Right.
human. So I'm curious, has doing this research affected your communication style at all?
Maybe in very slight ways. I mean, one thing so my particular field of expertise in speech perception is multisensory speech perception, which means how do you put auditory information about what I'm speaking with visual information about what I'm speaking. It turns out that simply looking at a person's face as they're talking is equivalent to reducing the background noise of their voice by almost half. So, there's a lot of research questions in there, but I definitely tend to look more at people's lips when I'm speaking now than I ever did before. And I also, when I'm watching TV, it seems like I'm a little particularly attuned to the delay between the acoustic signal and the visual signal. I'm obsessive about it. I tweak the little thing on my TV all the time because they have to be really lined up or it really annoys me.
So you don't ever do dubbed, you always do subtitles, in other words.
Well, for some things I do dubbed, like anime, like Japanese anime. I want to watch the art, so I'll just have the dub. But yeah, no, most of the time I'm really sensitive to the match between the visual and the auditory. Yeah.
So let's jump into a bunch of fun questions on this topic that I'm curious to explore with you. Do you think speech perception relies on one's ability to produce sounds?
That's a really great question. So one of the theories that's out there is that the way that we So the example I was giving before about deep and dupe, one of the examples or one of the theories about how the brain solves that problem is by internally modeling how those sounds would have been made by your own voice. And it's called the motor theory of speech perception. And the idea is that when I'm listening to a person speak, inside my head, I'm coming up with a pattern of motor activity in my throat and my tongue and my lips that would have created that sound pattern. And then I use that as the way of figuring out what was said. There's a lot less ambiguity in the articulatory patterns for a particular phoneme. So when I say deep and I say dupe, the beginning and the end are exactly the same for both of those words, right? The only thing that's different is the vowel, which is what we kind of would expect if it was a one-to-one relationship. So that's the argument in favor of a motor theory of speech perception. There's a little bit of evidence to suggest that, and full disclosure, the lab that I was trained in was brainwashed me into thinking that that was the right theory. So I do actually think it has to do with that. Yeah.
Let's say I stood two people in front of you. One person, I closed their eyes, another person, I had to look at your face, and then I had you read a paragraph out loud. How much do you think the person whose eyes are closed, how much are they going to miss?
So if it's in the clear, there's no noise, there's no background noise whatsoever, there's nothing affecting the person in terms of, they don't have any other tasks to worry about, they're not doing some kind of distractor task, they're probably going to get most of it. You can get most of the linguistic information that you need in those ideal conditions just auditorily, for sure.
Okay. I've been watching a lot of these AI generated videos. I'm sure you've seen them as well. Oftentimes, where gestures and facial expressions don't seem to match with the content that's being produced. How does our brain process that when those things do not match?
It's a really great question, and I'm not aware of any research directly about AI gestural mismatch, which but that sounds like a great idea. Maybe that's a way to go. But there is a lot of information out there about gestural mismatch with auditory speech. There's non-linguistic versions where the expression on the person's face doesn't match quite the emotion that's being conveyed by the speech. But they've even done something as simple as playing the acoustics of a person saying ba ba and the visual display of a face saying ga ga and playing them at the same time. So the auditory is saying ba ba, the visual is saying ga ga. They play them on top of each other. And you ask people, what did that person say? And they all, like 98%, say it sounds like da da, which isn't in the sounds and it's not in the sight, neither one. So the question is, what is going on? The brain is maybe splitting the difference, if you will, of what the acoustic signal is telling you it should be and what the visual signal should be, and then coming up with the best guess as to where it resides in the middle. So the visual part of communication can drastically impact the sound, like literally what you hear.
Yeah, it feels like that's a big impediment is getting those things to match with these AI generated videos. And, I mean, I've seen some that, appear to be fairly close, but I think they still have a long way to go on average or in the aggregate. Now, one
Yeah.
thing that I was thinking about while I was kind of looking into your field of study is I was thinking about adults learning foreign languages. And I was thinking about kind of learning a language on something like Duolingo versus immersion. What can speech perception teach us about learning languages as adults?
So, one of the things that you have to learn when you're learning a new language is the way phonemes sound in that language. So, I'm trying to learn Spanish right now, and people are always making fun of my accent. It's terrible. I grew up in New York. I've been a native English speaker my whole life. I don't have a good accent when I'm speaking Spanish. And the reason I don't sound right when I'm speaking Spanish is because the way my mouth makes those phonemes is different than the way someone who's a native speaker of Spanish would make them. And being immersed in a group of people who are speaking Spanish allows you direct access to the way that those phonemes should sound in Spanish. And one thing we also know is that the more variation you have, the more exposure to different varieties of different people saying different phonemes in different contexts, the more variety you have, the better off you are in the long run. There's a very famous, so in Japanese, the difference between R and L, the sound that R makes and the sound that L makes is not meaningful in Japanese. It's a meaningless distinction in Japanese. And so when native Japanese speakers speak English, that's often something that they struggle with, trying to hear the difference between R and L, because that's an important part of English. And they trained a bunch of native Japanese speakers who were learning English to recognize that distinction. And the people who did the best were the ones who heard that distinction across multiple talkers, across multiple speech samples. So the more variety you have, the better off you are at learning what it is that you're trying to get about the new language.
One of the things that was really interesting for me was this right ear advantage that I read about. It's a fascinating thing. How robust do you think the research is on that? And if so, should we just turn all of our students' desks to the left so their right ears can hear the lecture and they'll gather more?
Yeah, right ear advantage is really cool, right? And the fact is that most people have language processing centers in their left hemisphere, and there's a stronger contralateral connection in the auditory pathway between the right ear and the left hemisphere. But it should be noted that even though there's a right ear advantage, you still can understand speech through your left ear, and that's because the ears have connections to both hemispheres. It's just that there's a slightly stronger contralateral connection than there is an ipsilateral connection. So, it's interesting. It's really cool, but I don't know if it's functional in any way. We definitely can't have people only listening out of their right ear. The left ear plays a role. The other thing is that, even if it were only contralateral, the left ear's contribution to speech perception may not be specifically syntactic or phonetic, but your right hemisphere does get involved in certain aspects of language perception, like emotion detection and, that whole thing we were talking about before with the way the gestures match the sounds. The right hemisphere is involved in that sort of thing. So it's still important to have the left ear listen. It's just not tied to the fundamentals of sound and how those map to language.
Got it. When my partner was finishing her doctorate in psychology, she practiced a number of the tests on me, which is always fun to have your partner know your IQ, which, you know, she still has not told me, which I don't want to know. But one of the ones that was hard for me was like remembering a string of numbers, and then just having to spit that back. And, in looking at some of the different subfields within your field, one of the things that jumped out at me was this kind of word superiority effect. I found it very interesting. Do you think with training, people could overcome the word superiority effect, that they could remember random syllables just as well as words or syllables connected to words? Or do you think that that language instinct we have is just kind of a permanent thing?
It's a really interesting question. I don't know, but I would guess that someone has looked at that. And if I were just free to completely speculate, what I would think would happen is that if you started training people on random syllables, they'd almost start treating them like words. Because if you think about it, that's what a word is, right? Before you
know, so they would just say like, okay, this is a new word. This means this. And kind of like the memory palace that, if you're like memorizing a speech, so you're saying it would be probably a similar effect?
Well, you'd almost like wordify the string of syllables. I mean, the first time I ever heard boba tea, right? I didn't know what boba tea was, but it was boba tea, and it didn't mean anything. It was just a set of random syllables. But then, I had to buy it for my children every week or whatever it was, and then it became a thing. So, random syllables can be made into words once meaning starts being attached to it. And if the task is to memorize them, then you would start attributing meaning to it, and you'd probably treat it like a word over time.
Yeah. I don't want to be the one to conduct that study, but maybe someone. Okay. So we're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of stuff at you. You tell me whether you think it's over or underrated and why. Okay. So we'll start with one that I give to everybody, Me and Ed's Pizza, and especially someone that grew up in New York.
Yeah, overrated.
Okay.
I don't know how highly overrated I can go, but I would say way overrated.
where do you like to eat pizza in Fresno then?
I'm a big fan of Florentina's, which is in Clovis. That's as close to New York pizza as I get locally. Also, I like the Mamma Mia's pizza that you get down next to Lucy's Lounge in the tower.
Okay.
Those are pretty close. Yeah.
Gotcha. All right. Next one, the metaverse.
I would say overrated if we're talking about Meta's version of the metaverse, right? But if we're talking about just cyberspace in general, probably underrated.
Yeah, I feel like people tend to point out the flaws in Meta's metaverse, underrate the opportunity that that space could afford people. Obviously, we're on Zoom right now, and so we're interacting in a digital space, and so the things are limitless in terms of what we can do. And it's just, if you judge the entire field based on the first iteration of something, I don't think we'd ever get anything done meaningfully. So I think I agree with you. Next one, rote memorization.
Overrated.
Okay. It's not as valuable as people at least used to think it was.
No, not nearly as good. I mean, we know for a fact that your ability to remember something has nothing to do with the way you memorized it, has more to do with how many times you've tried to remember it. So rote memorization, yeah, it's okay, but interacting with a piece of information will help you remember it far longer.
Okay. Next one, Hoosiers. Either the movie or the team.
The team, I'm a Hoosiers fan. I became one when I went to Indiana University, so I'm going to have to say underrated, no matter how badly they're going to play that season. The movie is pretty fun, but it's a little old. Yeah, so I would say overrated.
All right, the next one. And this is something that I used a little bit when I was trying to learn German. I took a lot of German in college. Spaced repetition. So like the stuff that Anki uses and different software. I used one a while ago called Glossika, which was an interesting one. And instead of like having vocabulary words, it was like sentences that you had to memorize. So you kind of were learning the syntax through kind of like a repetitive or spaced repetition system. What do you think about those systems?
Yeah, they're great. They're empirically validated. In fact, one of my colleagues at Fresno State, Carl Oswald, does research on the spacing effect, and it's an excellent technique for remembering information.
Next one that could get you into trouble, Alliant University. We get a lot of psychology PhDs and PsyDs that come out of there. What do you think? Overrated or
Yeah,
underrated?
so I have a conflict of interest because I used to teach there, but I would say that it is, this is a tough one. I'm going to say underrated.
Okay. So it's a good place if you're considering a PhD locally in psychology.
The reason it's underrated is because a lot of students don't want to leave the area for various reasons. And so, it's their only option really for them if they want to get a PhD. On the other hand, it costs a lot of money. And it's not quite the same as getting a PhD from a big state school. So there's pluses and minuses to it for
Okay.
sure.
All right. Next one, Doghouse Grill.
Am I doing takeout or am I dining in?
Let's say you're dining in, so we give them the best possible experience.
Okay, well, so I'm very easily distracted and all
Oh,
those
okay. So for
TVs really
maybe
make it
taking
hard.
out for you is better experience. So if you're taking it out,
Yeah.
you've got a big basket of fries on your lap and you're watching a Hoosiers
Yeah.
game. That's
Yeah,
a good
that's
thing.
underrated. I love their food. I just can't sit inside because of all those TVs.
Oh my gosh, yeah, it's that I it's amazing how many people they get to sit in there relative to the noise
Really
and
is.
distractions. All right, this next one's something I know you have at Fresno State, and I'm curious, given that your research in video games, esports, are those under or overrated?
I think they're underrated. I think that's a huge area that's going to become more and more popular. I mean, obviously, kids are playing more and more video games. And I know for a fact, I have kids, three kids, all under the age of 20, and they literally go on YouTube and, Twitch and watch people playing video games. It's absolutely a spectator sport. I think it's nothing but more in that area to come.
Yeah, I would like, esports athletes to have, higher status in our society. Maybe some of the, other kinds of sports athletes could, they could be a little bit more of a level field in terms of the different kinds of sports. The biggest, obviously, change in this domain is chess players. Their status has increased in terms of
Yeah.
how we view them. But yeah, I think esports is a long way to go, but I hope it goes that way. Next one. This one is kind of a nerdy one that when I was in graduate school, lots of hipster philosophy majors and, you know, religious studies folks were into. Jacques Lacan, over or underrated?
You know, I'm not familiar with Jacques Lacan, unfortunately. Okay.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right. Let's skip on to the next one. Neuralink, over or underrated?
I think that's another one where it's like the connection to Elon Musk and the corporatizing of it is making it probably overrated. But in terms of the technology itself, very underrated. That is going to be huge. It really is. I mean, they first came out with prototypes of those maybe 10 years ago, and it's already reached the state that it's in now. There's nothing but vast potential there.
Yeah. I mean, if you really want to have your mind blown, watching that chimp or monkey play Pong with getting the banana shoots in his mouth, I mean, I think that's like, I mean, if that's just the tip of the iceberg, it's going to be a wild future.
Okay. It really is.
Two more in this section. You know, you lived in Indiana, so I got to ask, the show Parks and Recreation, over or underrated?
Oh, underrated. I thought that show was hilarious. And it was a pretty good representation of the way things are out there. Yeah.
In what way? Give us a little bit. Because Indiana is one of those states where I feel like people have an understanding based on a few small things, but I don't know. I mean, I may travel to Indiana at some point in my life. I don't think that's guaranteed. So, you know, your perspective on what it captured that was accurate.
You know, there's a lot of things about, I mean, first of all, I should say I lived in Bloomington, Indiana, which is where the university is, which is very different from the rest of the state. But I think there is, you know, different regions of the country have different cultures. And I think the Midwest culture, there are a lot of really pleasant things about it. And I think that they really represented those pretty well in Parks and Recreation. I thought the whole thing about Little Sebastian, the whole running joke about Little Sebastian in Parks and Rec was hilarious. And that kind of rallying around some kind of symbol for the town, it is exactly the sort of thing that I would expect from a Midwestern town like that.
Fantastic. Last one in this section, and I just read The Metaphysical Club, which is kind of a book about William James and a few other kind of famous kind of thinkers from the 19th century. I'm curious if you think The Principles of Psychology by William James is over or underrated these days.
Probably underrated because no one really even knows about it unless they take a history and systems class of psychology. And, you know, it's a seminal piece of work in psychology. Many of the ideas that we talk about today are derived at least from things that he talked about, if not directly related to things that he talked about. So it's probably underrated just because people don't even know about it.
Okay. All right. We're going to jump into a few more sections before we wrap up. First one is some more questions on psycholinguistics that I was curious about. What do we know about polyglots in terms of nature versus nurture?
Like if they have an affinity to
speaking
languages.
Like can you teach a person to be a polyglot, you think? Or do you think that's just there's some select people that have certain kinds of memories that allows them to learn multiple languages?
Yeah, I'm just speculating because this isn't really my area, but I would imagine that there probably are things that are specifically making someone have an affinity for learning languages. But whether those are inborn or acquired is a whole nother question. I mean, you think about a great basketball player, for example. Shaquille O'Neal obviously is a great, you know, great basketball player. Michael Jordan was obviously a great basketball player. And so they learn those skills, right? But there's also something innate about, you know, their bodies. They're just big, you know, their hands are big. They have higher reaction or slower or shorter reaction times. So there's lots of stuff in both areas that you might attribute to them being great basketball players. I think probably the same thing happens with a polyglot. You know, certain innate capabilities probably give them advantage. But then also their exposure to those languages probably plays a role as well.
Okay. Let's imagine I put you in charge of an SLP program and you could add some more psycholinguistics in a certain area that would support a future speech and language pathologist. What would you add?
The biological component. I mean, I know they learn a lot about the anatomy of the vocal tract and how it works and so on. But understanding a little bit more about the central processes that control them is probably worth taking the time to understand.
Okay. Is there a specific reason why you think would that help them with their practice, or it just helps them to give context to understand kind of contextually what how that system works within the body?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of understanding why things work rather than that they work, right? So if you have a little bit of an understanding of the underlying stuff, then you can better generalize your knowledge when new situations arise.
Okay. From your perspective, why is there so much debate about the science of teaching reading? And is it as vitriolic in universities as is in K-12?
Yeah, so it's odd to me. To be quite honest with you, you know, this seems like one of those things that is just an empirical, you know, it's just an empirical question, and you can do all sorts of studies to figure out what's the best way to do it. One thing that does tend to happen in academia, unfortunately, is that people rally around a particular theory, and a very famous memory theorist one time told me, his name is Alan Badley, he said, theories are like toothbrushes. No one wants to use anyone else's, and everyone has their own, right? And this is kind of a thing that happens in the scientific field. You build a career around a particular theory, you write papers around a particular theory, you train students to understand a theory. It's hard to let it go. So even though, you know, objectively in science, you should be ready to drop a theory, you know, when new data arises, in practice, it doesn't work that way. And I think people get emotionally attached. And that's probably what's going on there with the reading.
It definitely seems that way in the K-12 world. Now, two questions on video games. Do you think the association between video games and addiction is robust, at least in the research? Or do you think that it's going to come out later that there's some other confounding variables that maybe lead to addiction issues with those that play a lot of video games?
I think there's something to it for sure. I'm not sure if it's video games or just sort of like, you know, the dopamine rush that you get. There are probably video games that don't lead to addiction, but certainly things like Call of Duty or Overwatch or even Clash Royale that I'm particularly addicted to on my phone. Like, these are things that you get a little bit of a dopamine rush every time you play, if not a lot of a dopamine rush every time you play, and that's addictive. So there are probably ways to modify it, but I think there's something to it.
Okay. How do you think social skills differ in VR spaces?
That's a really interesting question, and it's something that's an active, you know, an active topic of investigation right now. There are pluses and minuses. So one of the big pluses is that you can interact with people around the world, right? One of the big minuses is that, what's the fidelity of the representation in virtual world of your gestures, of your emotional responses, the sort of intangible aspects of communication that aren't necessarily represented in a virtual space? That can play a role for sure, but it's only going to get better, right?
I think so. Do you think the goal is creating, as you know, using the word fidelity, close enough to my quote, in, you know, and I read a lot of kind of Buddhist texts. Do you think the goal should be like a faithful representation of your sense of self? Or is that kind of like a black hole in terms of we just, you know, what is your sense of self? And maybe you have two selves. You have your VR self and you have your, you know, physical space self. Do you understand what I'm getting at with that question?
I completely do. And I mean, we all have multiple selves, right? Every self, every context that we go into brings out a different self. So the underlying question of what is the self, even if there even is one, right? That's a really difficult question to answer. I think the fidelity that I was referring to was more like the fidelity to representing your intention, whatever self is putting that out there, you know, emotional responses, gestural responses, nonverbal communication, I think is going to be really critical to communication in those spaces.
Gotcha. All right. So we're going to jump into now a bunch of current psychology topics I'm interested to get your perspective on. So the big book of the year is by social psychologist Jonathan Haidt called The Anxious Generation. And I'm curious, in your mind, what would it take to convince you that phones and social media are leading to mental illness? Like what would it take?
I'm literally reading that book right now, and I'm already convinced. And I think the hard thing is once you start looking at it with a critical eye and you start thinking, okay, well, what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do as a consequence of knowing this? That's where it gets really difficult.
His solution sections suck because I don't think there's an easy solution, but you agree with him in terms of the problem.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I'm convinced that the evidence that he's describing, the sort of philosophical meanderings that go on, it's very persuasive.
Yeah, I'm mostly on the same team. It has been interesting to read the kind of contrarian takes on the book. And I don't think all of them are just shills for the technology industry. Like, I think there is some like genuine criticism, but I think it feels, you know, like technical issues with some of the data he's pulling from, but it doesn't feel like any of it really challenges the underlying conclusions that you should draw from the book. So I'm very much on the same team.
I'd be interested to see what the arguments against are. I mean, I used to be a technophile, you know, like prophet of the future. Everything's going to be technology. Social media space is going to revolutionize everything. And there are many benefits. You know, during the pandemic, all three of my kids maintained social connections with all their friends. No problem, right? So I do think there's something to it, but the drawbacks are pretty significant, and I'm very worried about those.
Robert Sapolsky also put out a book this year called Determined, which was his kind of, he's a neurobiologist, so I think kind of related to your field, but maybe slightly different, and where he makes a pretty robust case that free will is an illusion. Do you tend to lean towards his view of things, or do you take maybe a more compatibilist view?
I I'd love to read that book. I haven't read it yet. But what I do know about this issue is I'm a determinist. Yeah, I don't believe in free will at all. I think the evidence is pretty conclusive that we just think that we're in control, but we're actually not.
How do you handle that in your personal life?
Well, that's a whole nother question, right? I mean, maybe it is true that I'm not actually in control, but functionally, day to day, it's irrelevant, right? Yeah. I feel like I'm making choices, so I should make choices that actually, or I should intend to make choices that are compatible with the way I want to behave. Whether that actually controls things or not, it's completely irrelevant. And the other problem too is that once you scale up that very, very basic insight to the complexity of every day, it's really hard to draw a straight line between the two.
Yeah. So this year we lost a giant in the field of psychology, Daniel Kahneman. Thinking Fast and Slow was an important book to me. A lot of it, you know, I don't know, like we talked about before, I don't know if it's changed anything in terms of how I live my life, but at least I'm cognizant of when I'm engaging in, it has, because it makes me more judgmental of other people because I can see their cognitive biases a lot more accurately, which, you know, I, what's his name? The Enlightenment Now guy, Steven Pinker, kind of argued that, like, essentially, we need to be aware of these things so we can identify those issues in other people, so we can be better critical thinkers as a community. So kind of like an argument for peer review and, you know, looking at other people's ideas. But I'm curious what, if anything, you gathered from Daniel Kahneman that has left an impact on you.
Yeah, you know, I think similarly, just in terms of what he actually was talking about, I think it was useful to have a sort of an understanding of the underlying basis of these biases. But you know, as someone who's an educator, I've always kind of thought that it's important for people to understand the value, kind of like what you were saying about Pinker, the value of understanding that we can't possibly be looking at something objectively, right? There's inherent biases in the way we think. I mean, literally the reason there's something called the scientific method is because of observations of human bias, right? Which my scientist friends don't like me to point out that psychology is the reason that there's a science, but it really is the reason that there's a science. And so I, you know, just in general, I think it's good for the population at large to understand that, you know, no one's thinking clearly. Everyone's got stuff going on in terms of how they talk. And that's why we have systems in place like the scientific method.
And that kind of, leads nicely to my next question, which is, now that we're playing around with chatbots, lately I moved away from ChatGPT and now I'm on to Claude. I like Claude.
Okay.
Maybe it's just the UI experience, or maybe I just think that that chatbot is more my friend than ChatGPT was. But I'm curious from your perspective how this is going to change the way cognitive science looks at intelligence on based on, what we're seeing with chatbots and, a lot of the other AI features that are coming out.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really instructive. Actually, one of the first conversations I had with ChatGPT was, you know, are you conscious? And, you know, it gave me a standard kind of pat answer. Well, no, how could I be conscious? You know, I'm a computer. As I probed it with the literally the same questions that I would probe students with when I'm talking about these issues in like a history and systems and philosophy of psychology class, I got it to go pretty deep, and we eventually ended up at an impasse where it was saying, well, all I'm doing is spitting out statistical contingencies about words, and it just appears like it has meaning. And I said to it, well, how do you know that's not what I'm doing? And we just kind of kept going around and around on that very point. So at the very least, it'll reveal that that's really all we are doing. We're just a very sophisticated version of that. Or it'll reveal something that we just can't nail down in an algorithmic way, and maybe that'll propel us into a whole nother area of cognitive science.
I mean, do you speculate that we might learn some things about complexity and emergence through AI?
Yeah,
So what do you think?
exactly.
What do you think we'll learn from in that domain?
Well, if I knew, I'd probably be making a
Yeah,
million
if you knew,
dollars already.
you'd be running those companies. But I guess what I'm saying is, do you speculate that we'll start seeing patterns in terms of emergence with AI based on what you're seeing so far?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I use Chat. Like I said, I'm a technophile. I use ChatGPT for a lot of things. And lately, because it's the end of the school year, I'm writing a lot of scripts in Python to do data analysis. And what I'm finding is that it's very good at giving me a first pass at what I intend it to do. But I have to have some knowledge to A, interpret whether it's going to work the way it's intended to work, but B, to explain why it's wrong. So if I say, hey, that's not doing what I want it to do, here's what you actually need to do. I need to fall back on the information I know about how programs work from when I did it the old-fashioned way, right? To get it to write the script the way I want it to. And I think what's happening is I'm kind of hitting that edge of the solution space for the AI. And as we explore where that edge is and really define where that edge is, I think that's going to tell us a little bit more about what the limitations on emergence might be, and maybe we could start probing that as
Yeah,
well.
I'm very excited. I'm similar to you that I'm optimistic, but I also want to be cautious as well.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that universe. All right, before we close up, a couple questions, Fresno State related questions. What percentage of your students do you think desire to be mental health professionals, and does that modify how you teach?
Yeah, I would say the vast majority of them come to the psychology department with a goal of being in mental health. And, you know, as the person who doesn't teach any classes in that area, right? I teach methods, I teach stats, I teach language, I teach perception. I view it as kind of a challenge, you know, to try to get them to understand, hey, this is exciting and interesting, but B, it's relevant. And I enjoy that challenge. So when I do, the way I contextualize that in class is by trying as best I can to make it relevant when I can. So, for example, there's a whole section of my perception class where I talk about how different parts of your brain process different aspects of the visual scene. And one of those parts looks at the shape of objects, and you can selectively lose that with a stroke in a particular area of the brain. And then I go out and I find videos of patients who have had, you know, strokes in their infrotemporal cortex and show what their behavior is like. So the larger point is still there's a part of your brain that processes the shape of things that you're looking at, but try to contextualize it in a way that they might interact with later. That I think that helps.
Now, when you think back at your career at Fresno State, do you think students enter your classroom today with more or less misconceptions about psychology? And I'm asking this kind of in a loaded way, because I know there's a lot of, you know, social media, like TikTok psychology spaces that are giving them a lot of information, and some of those are coming from trusted sources and a lot aren't. So I'm curious, are like you having to unteach students some things that they enter the space with?
Well, that's the flip side advantage of being in the area where I don't teach anything in mental health, right? Because there's not a lot of TikTok misinformation about, you know, speech perception, right? Yeah. There are, however, a lot of visual illusions. And every semester I teach perception, I get at least, you know, 5-6 people saying, hey, this went through TikTok. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? And I think it's great, because even though the explanations on social media of these, you know, real Instagram reels, TikTok, whatever, even though the explanations are often wrong, it's great that it's out there. And then when they bring it to class, I have an opportunity to say, hey, this thing that you all are seeing, here's what the real explanation is, or here's what we think is happening with this. So I have a whole section of my class about the dress, you know, the white, gold versus blue, black dress that everyone argued about what color it was.
Yep, I did too.
And there's, you know, there's plausible, realistic, theoretical explanations of why that's the case. There's still parts that are unknown.
Yeah.
And it's a great opportunity to show students how perception works on a day-to-day basis.
I'm curious, in your role as chair of the department, do you have these discussions about changes in incoming students to the psychology department with maybe some of your faculty that teaches in those domains?
Yeah, I think a lot of time right now, everybody's recovering from the pandemic. That's my theory anyway. And I still think we are. And one of the things that's really pervasive is that I keep hearing is how the mores and expectations of being a student and being a teacher have changed pretty drastically since the pandemic, based on experience, based on the way things work. And we're all kind of trying to figure out, well, what do we have to do to reach these students who are very different, coming into a college education very differently than the students who would have come in 6-7 years ago before.
My partner doesn't like to talk about this, but I thought it was a good thing to talk about. I want to talk about statistics for a minute. Statistics is, I actually really enjoy statistics and think it's one of the most underrated fields that more people should know about, in part because, you know, I get friends that send me articles, even academic articles, where I know what the p-value says and they don't, or what it means rather. And they're like, look, this shows this causes this. And I'm like, well, let's look at the p-value. Let's talk about it. Do you think enough future psychology PhDs are equipped enough in statistics, and should we encourage them to take more? And I'm bringing this up because there's this replication crisis. There's a lot of areas where a lot of the research is being challenged. And I wonder if that's poor math skills that plays a role in that as well.
Yeah. If you had asked me this question before the replication crisis happened, I would unequivocally have said, yes, people need way more statistical. No, I had the experience of writing papers before the replication crisis where I would include statistics that were disambiguating or whatever, and reviewers would say, this isn't necessary. And I'd have to really like push to include it. And I was also on the flip side of that, where I was reviewing a paper and I said, there's not enough statistics to make this conclusion. And many times editors would actually overrule me. So at that time, I was really disillusioned with the amount of statistical knowledge that people had. Now, because of the replication crisis, I think it's becoming a lot more valued, and it should be. I always say, you know, like a biologist has a test tube, a centrifuge, a gene sequencer, an astronomer has a telescope. Psychologists have stats. That's our tool. And we should really know how our tool works very, very intimately, even if we're not doing research on stats, which there are people, right, who do that. But if we're using stats to research something else, we absolutely should know everything about it.
Okay. This is the last question before we talk about books. I always ask everyone to kind of think about how their particular position in their work affects the way they see Fresno. So I work in education like you, and I tend to look at the world and Fresno specifically through kind of an education lens, seeing both the problems and solutions in that domain. How does what you do affect the way you see Fresno?
It's a great question. I mean, I've only lived in Fresno from this perspective, right? I came here for my job.
Yeah.
So I've always kind of viewed Fresno as an educational space, you know, like the reason I live here is because of education. And I'm frankly very honored and humbled by the fact that I'm able to work at a university in this area. Students are really motivated. The students who come to Fresno State are extremely motivated to get an education. And that's something that I did not get from every single student in other places that I've been. So I really love the value that my students place on their education. And I also recognize that there are a lot of sociological issues going on in Fresno, poverty, discrimination, injustice, that are making it difficult for some of those students to pursue the education that they want to pursue. So it's like a work in progress. You know, I see how the town or the city is, you know, sort of mired in historical things that are holding it back. But at the same time, I also see the promise because so many students really want to be here in my classes. They really want to be in my classes. They really want to be in the psychology department. And, you know, we're coming up on graduation. That's my favorite. You know, I still get choked up when I say, hey, y'all did it. You know, this is 4 years of really, really hard work. And to see 300, 400 students just be like overjoyed at the fact that they got this piece of paper. It's a huge payoff. It really is.
That's my favorite part of the year as well. To close, what are a few books you'd recommend to listeners, either about your research area or something that's important to you?
Yeah, so we actually talked about one of them. I was going to talk about Jonathan Haidt, but I also was going to talk about Steven Pinker book, which I think is really, really interesting, especially if you're into psycholinguistics. He has one book called The Language Instinct, which is relatively old, but it gets to the basics. And then the other one is called The Stuff of Thought, which is a little bit more philosophical in that it talks about the difference between thinking and language. And it's actually a pretty deep question. It's really interesting to read that book. Another book that I was going to recommend is called Gödel, Escher, Bach, by Doug Hofstetter, and it's all about emergence, which we were talking about earlier. It really gets to the mathematical foundations of what emergence is, and it was hugely influential in my pursuit of the area that I'm in now. Again, it's relatively old, but the concepts are still. And then I have to come up with one on the spot. So it's not going to be a scientific book, but I absolutely am loving the series that The Expanse TV show was based on Amazon. If you want just a really light science fiction, but that's well done, that book series is fantastic.
Yeah, I still think science fiction is one of the most underrated genres, just in terms of, I heard someone describe it as a history of ideas. And I think that really captures what it is. And I've gotten into it more recently. I had the kind of typical knee-jerk reaction to mass market paperback covers that a lot of people do. But I think if you can move past some of the terrible art and aesthetics of some right. of the books, you could really learn a lot from, you know, like everyone, like I really enjoy Neal Stephenson, you know, that kind of hard fiction. And then I also enjoy, you know, your Ursula Le Guin and your kind of more high literary science fiction. There's so much good stuff out there. Is there certain
great.
science fiction authors that you really gravitate towards or important to you?
Well, there's some classicists, right? So Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov. Which, by the way, people should really read Isaac Asimov's iRobot series nowadays with AI coming up as it is. But, one of my favorite things to do in the science fiction space, every year they come out with an anthology of the work of the year's best short stories in science fiction. And you can pick up new authors there. But really importantly, and this is really cool, when you're talking about ideas, you absolutely see how the ideas build off of each other from year to year. Is the people are writing stories right now that are based on extensions of ideas that were brought up in the past, and next year they will bring up new things about those ideas as well. So it's really fascinating to look at from a sort of cultural perspective, and the books are very interesting as well.
Have you watched The Three-Body Problem or read the book?
I read the book. Yeah, I
Okay.
read the whole series. I'm a little hesitant to jump into the TV show because I literally can't imagine how they would do it in a
I'm
TV
exactly the same
show.
way. I read the book and the TV show makes me nervous. And I've only read the first one. I haven't read any more in the series. And I from what I understand in terms of screenplay, I think that's what I think they still call it a screenplay if it's a TV show, but like I think it adapts like all three books into a bigger narrative. And I'm like, okay, well, do I want to invest in those later books? And I think probably for me, someone that I've gotten into lately in the science fiction space is Samuel Delaney. And he's got a book called Babel 17 that I enjoyed recently. And it's all about, human thought and how our words can change reality. And that book exploded my brain in so many ways. And I think it was written in the 60s or 50s or something like that.
Oh,
So
cool.
there's just so much out there. And I couldn't recommend it more highly. We could probably talk about science fiction forever, but to close, what are you doing next? What are you working on these days?
Well, right now I'm finishing up the semester, so there's a lot of grading. I have a bunch of students who are finishing up research projects, and that's really fun and gratifying. And also, this is the kind of the season where I start fantasizing about all the main things I'm going to do over the summer when classes are out. I have a list pretty long. I probably won't get through the whole thing, but I'm looking forward to exploring the AI space with regard to teaching, to be honest with you. There's a lot of tools that are popping up, and I want to see, are they useful? Are there ways for me to incorporate them? Because I definitely think this is a, if you can't beat them, join them kind of thing.
Adapt or die.
Exactly. So I'm looking forward to exploring those tools over the summer.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. It was fascinating, and I appreciate you coming on. And yeah, there's so much more we could talk about, but we're out of time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So thanks again for doing this with me.
And thank you for having me. I'm honored.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.